And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
On this podcast, I'm going to answer a number of your questions. But before I talk about some very specific questions, I want to talk about a subject of your comments and questions in a very general way. And it has to do with your desire to figure out, should I be more or less aggressive? When should I be changing to more, adding more fixed income to the portfolio? Should I be getting out right now and putting this money aside because I have enough money to last for the rest of my life? And honestly, I'm afraid the market is going to have a huge decline. I have these kinds of conversations and emails almost every day. And here's the challenge. The challenge for me is, because I am not a licensed investment advisor, I can't give you specific advice. I can't help you create your personal glide path as to when you would be adding fixed income to your portfolio, when you would be moving from small cap to large. There are so many variables that go into making those kinds of decisions. Sometimes, for instance, if I have a chance to really get to know somebody, I find out they have a dedication to leaving a lot of money to others. And it's not going to be used in their lifetime. So it's an interesting situation. You have a chance to discuss, should you be investing this money for your lifetime or somebody else's? Should you be investing as a senior citizen, or in some cases, a two-year-old, because the money is being set aside for a two-year-old? Or if it's being set aside for education, maybe because that money will be needed in 2 or 3 years, you don't want to take any risk. So it would be unfair to you for me to spend 3 minutes on the phone with you and tell you, here's what you should do. But here's what I try to do. I try to give generic information and then a ton of numbers. I don't know a better story than the numbers. And I know, by the way, that the numbers are a fable at this point. They are a story about the past. You don't even probably know what happened in 1983 that might have made the market go up or down or sideways. All we know is the number at the end of that year that we could easily, on our tables that we provide, you could look to see how you would have done had you been in the S&P 500, had you been in the all-value portfolio, had you been 50-50 U.S. international, and on and on and on. The numbers are there. They reflect a time and the forces of demand and supply. And quite honestly, I don't know every reason, every blip along the way. I can see, though, kind of the nature of risk and what it takes to maintain a portfolio for the long term, assuming, of course, that capitalism survives. But here is what I think that many of you should do. And in many cases, I suggest with the help of a professional. And there are a ton of them, really great professionals, who act like they care about people like you. So you just may have to take some time to find them. But let's talk about a couple of these big questions about, how should I be changing my portfolio? Because there is some change in my life. So I think we need to go back to the very basic decision about what our primary objective is for this portfolio. Is it, and I've been through this before, but I think it bears going through one more time, is it that your goal is to beat the market? And I'm not exactly sure what beat the market means. Does it mean that if you're in the small cap market, you want to beat the small cap market? Or if you own a S&P 500 kind of a fund, you want to beat the S&P 500? Or is it that at the end of the year, when they report what the S&P 500 did, you'd like to do better? That is and has been the primary objective of a lot of investors. In fact, I find that to be a very common objective amongst first-time investors. Somebody has planted that idea that they should be trying to hit the home run, the 10-bagger, whatever you want to call it. But that is a primary objective for some people. Other people, maybe they've been around a while and they've seen some good times and some bad times. And as they reflect on the bad times, it's a little scary because they remember the market going down 50%. In fact, I'm 74 and I've been through it hands on. I've been through the 73, 74, the 87 one-day crash of 22.5%. The 2000 through 2002, the 2007 through 2009. And those were all, in their own way, catastrophic to a lot of people. And so maybe we'd like to get a good return, but we want to get that return within our risk tolerance. So I see the second primary objective is to get the highest return you can within your risk limits, which means that it starts with understanding how much you're willing to lose. And then the hunt is for the combination of asset classes that will lead to those losses. Now think about that for a second. You're looking to invest with a strategy that says, I am willing to lose half of my money, and therefore I'll put it all in a diversified equity portfolio. You could also say, by the way, I'm willing to lose all of my money in the hopes of a huge return, so I'll put it in one stock, because that's the risk you take with one stock, is the loss of everything. But a lot of people who used to say, I want to beat the market, now think in terms of trying to get the highest return within the risk tolerance or risk limits. And again, that means knowing yourself. And then the third group that I just see these three groups represent most people. And by the way, some are a combination. Some maybe have 10% of their money they want to beat the market, and 50% of their money they want to get the highest return they can within their risk tolerance. And maybe that last part of the money is, I want to find the lowest risk way to achieve the rate of return that I need, or want, I guess, to meet my long-term objectives. So that's really a very different hunt in terms of finding the right combination. So from my experience as an investment advisor, part of the fun, and I mean it is fun, to sit with somebody. Sometimes it takes an hour or two to go through this, but to figure out what it is they really want their money to do. There is a fourth objective. I think it's a crazy one because it doesn't make any sense to me. Of course, that doesn't make it crazy, but it's real, and that is, I want to do better than my neighbor. I want to show the world I'm smart by the return I get. And of course, Fact is, we have almost no control of the return that we get. Oh, yes, we can control expenses, and we can control turnover, and we can control the asset classes. But you do all that good stuff that you can control, you're still left with this unknown as what the market is going to do for or to you. The interesting challenge for the person who says, I want to find the lowest risk way to achieve the return I need, I think the challenge there is that suggests that it needs to start happening now. It isn't something likely that we're going to be talking about later. When people need a certain amount of money, it's because in most cases they've reached the point that they need to see the cash flow, and the cash flow needs to hopefully leave a little room for growth after you take the money out. But you can see that it's nearly impossible for me to know you well enough from an email, and yet a lot of people email me writing, asking for advice, and I feel for you, because it suggests to me that you don't have an advisor in your life that you trust to go through this stuff with you. Or maybe because you heard I don't ever get paid for what I do, that I'll just be a freebie. I don't know. But it may be that when we go through this, should I sell? Is it time to go to more bonds? All of these questions that you have to separate, how much of that is market timing, how much of that is an actual change in my long-term position in terms of risk and, let's say, willingness to accept a lower return in exchange for having less risk. So if you're really struggling with that, understand if it's a market timing question and you're trying to just figure out, when do I get out and not lose another 50% like I did in 2000 through 2002, and then I did it again in 2007 through 2009. I don't want to do that again, you're thinking. In which case, you shouldn't be all in equities. But even if you found being partly in bonds at that period in your life was not the answer, here's what you probably need to do, particularly if you're going from being an accumulator to a distributor, from somebody saving for the future to using their savings to support the present and the future. Boy, there's a big decision to be made there as to how much in stocks and how much in bonds. And by the way, we're about to bring out the updated distribution tables, and I look forward to sharing those with you. So is it time to make a major change in your portfolio? Well, I suspect if you sat down with a professional and they looked at your situation, the needs, risk levels, and all those things, there's undoubtedly some changes to be made. They may not even be the changes you think that you're focused on. It may be you've got a lot of holdings in your portfolio that are things that were good ideas 20 years ago and you're still sitting on them. That may be one of the things that you'll actually end up focusing on is getting rid of the stuff that isn't likely to give you what you're looking for and putting it somewhere where you're likely to get what you want or need. So stay tuned. You know, I do all these pieces on fine-tuning your asset allocation. Got one coming up next week. And maybe that'll be a help in determining should you be changing that balance of equity and fixed income for the long term. Unless you're a market timer, by the way. If you're a market timer, then doggone it, do what the market timing system says to do. These markets going up and down in big steps, as they have been lately, they can drive somebody trying to maintain a market timing discipline nuts. And it's the reason that most people who try market timing will fail. And it's because when you're a market timer, every time you make a decision, whether it's a mechanical system or your I can't stand it anymore system, you are at the risk of having the market go exactly the other direction than what you thought it was going to do. On the short-term basis, and investing is already tough enough to get people to stay in for the long term when they're not even being asked to do something, but with market timing and you're being asked to do something all the time, theoretically, it makes it a very difficult strategy to maintain. All right, so let me get into the specific Q&A pieces that have come up recently. A listener asks, Paul, I currently use your suggested portfolio for Fidelity at 70-30. Now, 70 means 70 equity, 30% fixed income. Would it be fine to use the GlidePath spreadsheet for Paul's best at motif, but use Fidelity ETFs in place of your best in class due to my account being at Fidelity? And then he lists the ETFs that he would use to replace the best in class recommendations. The answer, by the way, is absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think that there probably will eventually be people who will use our GlidePath work for those motif and also at M1, they'll use those glide paths to put together their portfolio that they have in their 401k, because even if you use our recommendations within a 401k plan, you still need to know when to move from equity to fixed income as you age. And so the glide path, I think, that we have created for some, not for everybody, because it is an aggressive glide path, I think you will find it helpful. And by the way, I'll have ask Aisha if we can have a link to the glide path spreadsheet that we've developed. And in fact, this person says that the GlidePath spreadsheet, while being able to enter the date manually, is a great help in rebalancing and following the allocation model. Anyway, well done. I think that's a great solution, is to apply the same asset classes within your Fidelity account. Here's another question. Says, Paul, I enjoy your podcast and listen every week. Boy, that's music to my ears. Thanks for the excellent advice via podcast articles and books. As you were discussing the ultimate buy and hold portfolio, you mentioned results with yearly versus monthly rebalancing. I have most of my assets in a taxable account, and with the recent year's growth in my long-term investments come unrealized capital gains. Thus, I am leery of rebalancing due to tax implications, even though the allocations are somewhat imbalanced. And he, in parens, he says more than 5%. So here's the question. Do you take tax consequences into account in any way when you project asset growth in the various portfolios? Well, there are a number of things that are not accounted for in the fine-tuning tables or the distribution tables. And one is, of course, taxes. With the distribution tables, there's what to do with the minimum required distribution and how to consider that as a part of the distribution strategy. So, but in the case of a taxable account, we don't consider taxes. I've always looked, by the way, as taxes being a cost of living. And that to the extent that you're taking money out of your investments, you have to consider those taxes as a part of the, again, at the cost of living. There are a number of things you can do, theoretically. If you're adding money to the account on a regular basis, you would use that new money to help rebalance your portfolio. If you're taking distributions, you can try to take the distributions out of the funds that would get you back into balance. Here's the big problem, I think, with not rebalancing, because I have, for a lot of people, recommended they not rebalance. The challenge is that you start out with some balance of fixed income and equity. Then as you age, theoretically, you go to more fixed income. And if you're not rebalancing from your equity over to your fixed income, then what's likely happening is as you get older and more conservative, you're taking more risk because of the tax consideration, you're not rebalancing. Now, I guess I'm more concerned about the rebalance from equity to fixed income than I am within the equity part of the portfolio. And at the point that you start keeping track of the taxes from the rebalancing process, you also have to remember there are likely capital gains and dividend distributions that would have to be taken into consideration as well. So when I look at the list of projects to work on, I'm guessing this is one that will be some time before I get around to it. I will, though, do some research and see if I can find a good article that somebody has done on this topic. Another question from a listener says, thanks for your continuing public education on sound investment. I always enjoy reading the newsletters and some podcasts. I have just recently moved our portfolios and IRAs into Schwab. He says, I would like to have a professional advisor to review and reset my portfolio allocations, maybe once or twice a year, as well as other general financial advice. I just don't have the knowledge and the know-how to do it myself. Can you recommend a few such people that would do it for a fee? Or perhaps there are some good portfolios that would balance the accounts automatically and charge a slight or no fee. I used to have an easy answer for this. I would simply tell people to go to GarrettPlanningNetwork.com and find an advisor in your area. These advisors work both on an hourly basis as well as a percentage of the assets if you're asking them to manage the money. I think you can find an advisor through Garrett, but I'm not sure you're going to find them close to where you live. But there are many of them that will work via the phone, which is when I had my business, we had over half of our clients were outside the state of Washington. And most of our clients, we never met them face to face. It was all done over the phone. Now, here's the challenge. Every Garrett Planning Network advisor, if they've signed the contract with Cheryl Garrett, and it's a very fine organization, and she's absolutely dedicated to getting people hourly advice. So they all have to to agree to this hourly, giving hourly advice. But some of them, I've found, what they do is they'll give you the hourly advice, but they want you to sign a contract, that maybe put you on a retainer. The kind of hourly advice I picture is that where you simply find a good advisor who's willing to serve people, much like a doctor would, to come in and take care of a particular problem. And that you might have doctors who have these concierge services where you pay something extra to be able to get this immediate access. But I am sure there are lots of Garrett Planning Network people who will work on an hourly basis. Now, the tricky part is this. I know you'll find one who will review and give you recommendations of things you should do. You want to take another step. You would like somebody not only to discuss it, but you would like somebody who would actually take the steps to do the rebalancing. Now, rebalancing is becoming more and more common. I know, for example, in the M1 and the Motif projects that we've worked on, these are people, much like many robo-advisors, who were set up to do a completely automatic kind of a rebalancing process. So we know that can be done. And you may have to find somebody within the Garrett Planning Network. And so I'm thinking that if when you go to the Garrett Planning Network, and you'll see a list of advisors all over the country, and you can start by clicking on the map for advisors who are close to you. But you may have to make a few phone calls to see if one of them will do it. But if that's not getting you where you need to go, I think you ought to call Cheryl Garrett direct. I don't have the phone number right here. I'll tell you what I'll do. In the notes to this this podcast, I'll include her phone number to her main office and see if somebody in her office or Cheryl herself will be able to tell you an advisor who would do that kind of work. And I will give her a call and give her a heads up that I've mentioned this on the podcast. Next question, can you create a best of the commission-free mutual funds and ETFs portfolio? And what this person is asking us to do is to look at, for example, Vanguard has a commission-free portfolio. Fidelity has commission-free ETF trading. Not all, but they have their own ETFs or agreements with suppliers or vendors who have them. We also have the same at TD Ameritrade. And so what this person is looking to do is to, they've got money at Fidelity. They've got money at Vanguard. They've got money at TD Ameritrade. I'm not sure about TD Ameritrade, but I know at Vanguard and Fidelity. And what they would like us to do is to put together a portfolio so they could have part of their money at Fidelity investing in those commission-free that we recommend and at Vanguard for the others. No, the answer is no. We will not be doing this. And I'll tell you why. We're trying to keep it simple. And every time we add another portfolio, I know that it creates another question. Is this something I should be looking into? Is the implication because we've got it there. What I do think is worth considering is when you go to Vanguard, for example, they do not have some of the asset classes. But we have made recommendations in our best of class ETF portfolios which, if you were using those portfolios, which ETF that you would use, which means you could, in fact, at Vanguard, use all the Vanguard portfolio ETFs we have and simply buy one or two more ETFs to round out what you need. And what's it going to cost you? Well, it depends on how much money you have at Vanguard. I assume that you'd be using an online approach to doing the trades. If you do it over the telephone, it's going to cost you $25. But if you do it online at Vanguard and you have less than $50,000 under their management or in the account, then it's going to cost you $7 for the first 25 trades. If you have $50,000 to $500,000, it's $7 a trade, but it's for as many as you want. If you have $500,000 to $1 million, it's $2 per trade. And if you've got $1 million to $5 million, it's free for the first 25 trades, and then it's $2 a trade. And I think you can even go higher. If you have over $5 million, you get 100 free trades, and then it's $2 a trade. So it may be that you'll have enough that you're going to maybe even get it free. But even if you've got less than $50,000, we are talking about a $7 trade. So let's say that you've got a great portfolio at Vanguard, but it's missing a couple of asset classes. Well, I would think that it would make sense to go in and just pick those up through the other recommendations that we've made and pay the $7 a trade or $2 a trade. Here's a question from a 32-year-old, and it has kind of some of the same question that I just discussed in the previous question, but in this particular case, he says, "Hey, Mr. Merriman, I like reading your articles and listening to your podcast. I find them to be very informative. I'm contemplating the idea of having an all-value asset allocation or a small-cap value allocation in my Roth IRA at Vanguard. I tried to look for recommendations of either asset allocation for Vanguard on your for Vanguard on your website and could not find them. I'm wondering if you have suggestions on how I should be weighted and in which ETFs." Now, here we go back to this situation where Vanguard doesn't have all of the asset classes as a commission-free purchase. But if you're 32 years old, and you're talking about investing this money, let's just say for 30 years, then I'm not worried about paying a $7 a commission in order to get into a fine fund. So you would have no problem looking at the ETFs at Vanguard, and just look at the list. You'll see the large cap value. You'll see the small cap value, And you'll actually also see that we recommend VWO, the emerging market at Vanguard. But I would also suggest that you divide that emerging market money, because you want 10% in the portfolio, between VWO and E as an Edward WX, 5% each in those two. That will give you a balance of a larger cap emerging market and a small cap emerging market. And also, I would recommend the Wisdom Tree International small cap ETF. That's D as in dog, L, S as in Sam. Now, as far as percentages, and we've got this on the site. If you look under best in class, you'll see this. But the percentages I'd like you to have would be 25 each in the large and small cap value U.S. I would like 20% each in the large and small value, and there Vanguard does have the large international value ETF, and we've got that in the recommended list. Plus, you'll pick up DLS, and then 10% split between EWX and VWO. That's the all value portfolio. And I do think that for a 32-year-old, that is a wonderful long-term position to be in. I got a whole bunch of questions from one of our followers, and I will address one of them, and then the others I'll address in the next podcast, because I've already got a ton of stuff on this one and going to keep you longer than you may be comfortable. But anyway, this person says, when will your 2018 mutual fund recommendations for tax-deferred and taxable portfolios be published? They're waiting for that to invest some of their money. And I will just say that we did make several changes during the year last year. So I am not anticipating for the next couple of months anyhow to make any changes. It could be as late as June before anything more. So I would suggest that you go ahead and take the position if you're anxious to get in the market, but as I say, it could be June before we make any changes, because we did make a few changes in the last half of last year as well as the early part of last year. Here's a wonderful question and a comment here, because I am going back to both Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin later this month for evening presentations to the AAII, American Association of Individual Investors. Very excited to go back and have a chance to meet with both groups. But in this email, this gentleman says, I just received my AAII local meeting notice and found out you are planning to come to Milwaukee for our chapter meeting in March. By the way, that information is going out in our newsletter this week. I will mention, in Madison, they don't charge anything for people to come out. And in Milwaukee, I don't remember what the cost is. It's never much, but it is. I love for you to come out if you're in that area. I am particularly interested in having a chance to talk with people about the comments regarding the website, the podcast, the recommendations for funds and ETFs and the 401k. I'd love to be able to have a conversation, the things that you would like to see us do in the future, and the things that you would like us to do better to make it easier for you. This person does mention, he says, I have a question about creating a diversified portfolio based on being global neutral. Now, that's an interest. I actually have not seen that term before. I know what it means, particularly when he goes on to say, meaning the weights of the diversification is based on the market cap of the U.S. and international economies. Today, my advisor has built my portfolio with DFA funds, with each equity portion proportioned to the relative market capitalization of the countries. It is built around large, small, core, and value U.S., international, and emerging market funds. He goes on, I don't see many studies on this strategy other than from DFA. Is this a standard DFA strategy, or is this more of an advisor strategy? It's a great question. DFA advisors, and I was one of those folks when I was an advisor, DFA advisors have to go to class put on by DFA. It's a two-day affair, probably two of the most exciting days in my business life. I loved it because I learned so much. I think every person who comes back from that 2 days has become an evangelist for what they've drunk the Kool-Aid that DFA has prepared, because they do have a different way of building the funds themselves, how they manage the funds to be in many ways more efficient than a traditional index fund. And they teach you how you can put the DFA funds together to build a portfolio, but it's not you have to. Every DFA advisor can build it the way they think it is in the best interest of their client. Obviously, there's no benefit to them if they base it on a capitalization-weighted basis, like this particular DFA advisor is doing, or they do it on an asset class weighting. Now, let's just think about that for a second, and I'll show you how different DFA advisors could be. I don't know all the details, but this suggests that in terms of global exposure, if the U.S. market represents 40% of all public companies, that DFA advisor's client is going to get 40% and 60% international. From what this person has said, it suggests that they even go further and look at the individual countries. I'm not exactly sure how they're doing that through DFA. But theoretically, it could be done somewhat. I don't believe in trying to build a portfolio based on capitalization. I really am a believer in finding asset classes, whether they be U.S. or international, that have a very long history of success, so that I could say theoretically, if you had owned any of these asset classes, that you would have done well. Now, having said that, if you've listened to me before, you know that you would have done probably much better in small cap value than you would large cap blend. But large cap blend is less risky than small cap value. But the portfolios that I've been building since 1993, using these different asset classes, are based on the idea that I don't really know whether small cap value will be as good in the future as it has in the past, particularly for people who might need to have these investments do well over a relatively short period of time, like a 50-year-old might, or a retiree might. Now, if somebody is investing for a lifetime for a newborn baby, I could see being very heavily weighted to small cap and small cap value. But I don't place any big bets. I say 10% in the S&P 500, I'm only talking about the equity portion, is plenty. 10% large cap value, and the same with the small cap blend and small cap value, and in a tax deferred account REITs, and then international large and small, and blend and value, and then emerging markets. In fact, I really think it's neat that DFA has a fund that is a combination of small cap and value and large cap. very efficient way to build a portfolio. So my approach is very different. It's not capitalization weighted. By the way, if you do capitalization weight a portfolio, it's going to look like the total market index at Vanguard in the U.S. You are going to own mostly very large growth-oriented companies. Not going to have much small cap because it's based on the size, the capitalization weighting of those companies. So you will find from one DFA advisor to the next a difference in how much they'll have in U.S. and international. And by the way, remember, one of the things we've done is over the last years is to produce tables that show the long-term outcome of 70% U.S., 30% international, and 50% U.S. and 50% international, because a lot of people are uncomfortable having a 50-50 U.S. international. So what does that do to your expectations for risk and return? It's a little different, not much, a little different. But DFA advisors will have different amounts of large and small. Now here I am, a 74-year-old guy, married to an only slightly younger woman, we have half of our equities in small cap. And more than half of our equities in value. And that's because the blend part of our portfolio it's not all growth. It's a combination of growth and value. But at 74, some people would say, whoa, that sounds very risky to be half in small cap. Turns out, if you look at our fine-tuning tables, and I'll be talking about a bunch of those next week, that the difference between having a 50-50 small and large and 50-50, let's call it growth and value, is not that much different in terms of risk from the S&P 500. But the return historically is significantly different. And while I'm not worried about putting bread on the table anymore, I am. I do want to do the best I can with the equity part of our portfolio for children and charities. But I also know at this point, I don't want to lose the kind of money that you lose in an all-equity portfolio. So we've got half of our money in fixed income. That's the way that we are addressing the risk of equities, is with the fixed income. And even there, you'll see a huge difference in the fixed income that an advisor might use. My approach has been to use very stable fixed income because the risk is coming out of the equity part of the portfolio. And what I'm looking for is fixed income that when all hell is breaking loose and the world is scared to death, the market's going to collapse big, big time. I like the fact that where do they rush? They rush typically, historically, into U.S. government bonds. And in fact, in 2008, when the market was collapsing badly, U.S. government bonds did well. Corporate bonds did not, because those guarantees were from corporations that were having some pretty difficult times. So you're going to see a wide range of strategies from DFA advisors. Now, DFA does make some kind of general ideas of how people could do it. And I'll tell you, a lot of advisors keep their life simple, and they just do kind of the traditional easy approach to putting together a portfolio. There are a number of firms. My old firm, Merriman Wealth Management, out of Seattle, that firm has been built having their own research department. and some of the smartest people I've ever worked with. Of course, I never worked with Dr. Fama and Dr. French, so I know that DFA, for example, has a great research department. Anyway, wherever you go, whether it's a DFA advisor, a Vanguard advisor, a Fidelity advisor, I would like each one of them to make the case. Why are you recommending it the way that you are? Show me the numbers. Show me the money. Anyway, off my soapbox, long enough to say thanks for listening. Next week, as I mentioned, I'm going to be doing a one on fine-tuning your asset allocation. Very excited to do that one. Then another week of Q&A, and then I'm coming back with something that's brand new. I am absolutely pumped to talk about the implications of using the strategies that we've been advocating for years, but instead of thinking in terms of distributions in retirement, what do those strategies suggest about the accumulation period? It's a new table, and boy, do I love this new table. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.